Hello, this is the On Science podcast, a roundup of our favorite stories this week from the science desk at NPR. I'm Andrew Prince, a web producer here. This week, we'll talk bugs, billions and billions and billions of them, traveling on little bug highways in the sky. Then we'll travel down to sea level and explain why clearer water in the San Francisco Bay might not always be good news. And the World Cup wrapped up this week with a stunning extra time finish and a victory for Spain. So we've got two stories for you about soccer. Joe Palka investigates the physics of the new extra smooth soccer ball, and Robert Krulwich listened to that buzzing vuvuzela. It became the unofficial soundtrack of the World Cup, so find out what it has in common with alligator pits and supermassive black holes. But first, we'll start with evolution. The question, what makes us human? What has allowed us humans to become the dominant species on the planet? The NPR Science Desk is exploring this question and others in a series we're calling The Human Edge. Science correspondent Chris Joyce started by asking anthropologists what they think was the most important change that made us humans so successful. So, Chris, what'd you find out?
That if you ask four experts, you'll get five opinions. Usually, whatever it is a scientist is studying at the time is the thing that made the difference. Here's a taste of what I got.
The enlarged brain?
I think it's sort of group sharing of knowledge. I think that's it.
I would put the foot at the very top.
You know, bipedality, walking on two legs.
Our ability to work together in these large societies.
There's no one thing.
Those were anthropologists Matt Tacheri, Christian Tryon, and Will Harcourt Smith.
Wow, they really are all over the map. But I guess we've got to start the story of evolution somewhere.
Well, why don't we start with some Fred and Ginger? As Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers proved, you can do some amazing things with two legs. But two-leggedness, bipedalism, is rare among living things. Four legs is easier. It's stable, and you can cover ground a lot faster. And that's been the animal architecture of choice for eons, at least for most mammals. Our earliest primate ancestors were no exception, whether moving in trees or knuckle-walking on the ground. But somewhere along the line, primates discovered how to stand up and walk on two legs. And after millions of years, it got us to where we are now. Now, no one's suggesting that natural selection led our species to wear high heels. Natural selection favors new traits that give their owners a survival advantage. And as anthropologist Ian Tattersall points out, it all starts by chance.
You know, natural selection can't call new things into existence just because they're desirable. Novelties happen randomly.
And, says Tattersall, who works at the American Museum of Natural History in New York, it takes a long, long time for novelties, like standing up to walk, to take hold and change a population of animals.
The earliest hominids didn't become upright walkers the way we are right away.
The hominids, our ancestors and their close relations, were adapted to living in trees. But there may have already been something going on in their bodies that predisposed them to walk on two legs, like standing up and walking in the trees, a bit like orangutans do now, reaching their arms up to branches to brace themselves as they move along.
I don't think you come down to the ground and decide it would be a really good idea to stand upright and move around. I think the only reason you would do it is because this is what came naturally to you in the first place.
This tree walking may have been something even monkeys did. Primitive monkeys started to split off from the lineage that led to apes and humans over 30 million years ago. Some of them also evolved to walk upright. Their walking style is a lot more primitive than ours, but it could hold clues to how our own ancestors learned to walk. That's not an anthropologist, it's Parker, one of two spider monkeys at a lab at Stony Brook University in New York. Susan Larson from the anatomy department is coaxing Parker down an enclosed trackway where scientists videotape monkey walking.
He's very good at it. They do it in the wild.
Larson is trying to understand how the muscles and bones in the monkey allow Parker to walk. Badly, a sort of high-stepping goose step, but nonetheless walk.
So if you have structures that appear the same, look the same, in humans and monkeys, then the reason why they look the same is because they work the same.
Structures like a wide blade at the top of the hip bone, that allows for more muscle attachments to help in balancing. Features like these seem to be part of a kind of walking toolkit. If some of the same tools show up in fossil bones of our ancestors, that could explain the early evolutionary changes that allowed us to walk. When our ancestors first walked on the ground seems to be about 6 or 7 million years ago, but why they did it is harder to agree on. Anthropologist William Jungers at Stony Brook favors the look ma hands hypothesis.
When animals walk bipedally, other primates, it is often in the context of carrying, whether they're carrying food items, stones. I think carrying is the most plausible precursor for bipedality.
Free hands may be the devil's playground, but they gave our ancestors the means to gather and carry food and eventually make tools. Free hands improved the chances of a long life and many offspring. There are other ideas, though. One holds that the African climate dried out and forests turned into savanna. Without dense forests, our ancestors had to walk instead of swing on a branch to find the next tree. Whatever the reason, though, walking was still just a part-time thing for millions of years. Trees were still our home base.
When you're going to travel, you come to the ground and you move, whether it's through the forest or across the savanna, it doesn't matter. You're a biped when you're moving. But where do you sleep? You sleep in the trees. Where do you move to escape predators? You move to the trees.
You can see evidence of this split-level lifestyle in the bones of one of our early relatives, Lucy, the pint-sized Australopithecus who lived about 3 million years ago. She had longish legs and a big toe in line with the other toes, both good for walking. But her hands and arms were still built for climbing. Her strategy was to be mistress of both worlds. But mistresses eventually have to make a choice.
The real question is, why did we abandon that strategy or choose an alternative strategy?
The alternative being full-time living on terra firma. Again, no consensus on why. Maybe the African forests thinned out. Or walking led to running and hunting down bigger meals. One thing for sure, though, the more we walked, the more our bodies changed.
We've elongated this lower part of our body.
What does that give us?
It locomotion really is priced by the step. So an increased stride length has tremendous economical advantages.
The longer leg meant we could go farther with a given amount of effort. Other changes followed. A springy arch in our foot also made us more efficient walkers. We developed a spine that centers our weight over our legs to keep our balance. As a result, we did better than other primates. First-rate walkers could travel to find food, water, or the best stone for tools. Wanderlust was born, romantic walks on the beach. Bipedality made a big difference in a hostile and unforgiving world. Eventually, a new genus was born, Homo, humans. Not the noble savage, but the mobile savage. And except for a few throwbacks...
Tarzan!
Jane!
We've kept both feet on the ground ever since.
Okay, so we made the trek down from the trees to the ground, but other tiny animals are moving up in the world. It's summertime, and that means long days, warm nights, and bugs. If you step outside and look at the clear blue sky and ask yourself, what's up there? You might see a cloud or two, or maybe a bird, but according to researchers, that empty-looking sky is just teeming with wild animals. Very small wild animals, but wild animals nonetheless. And Robert Krulwich wanted to know more.
How did you even happen onto this question? Are you a guy who looks up a lot? Or
Yes.
Matt Greenstone studies bugs. He's a research entomologist in Maryland, and years ago, he says...
On a balmy fall afternoon, I was biking home when suddenly little black specks started falling out of the sky.
Down they came, little black dots, looking kind of like strange black rain.
And there must have been, I'm sure there were, millions of them.
And as they landed, he thought, now, wait a second, these things, they're alive. Because if you look really closely at them...
You could see that they had legs.
8 legs.
These were spiders.
Spiders.
So they had just fallen out of the sky.
And if this freaks you out, hold on, because we're going to ask a very interesting question here. Matt figured...
What comes down must have gone up. And how in the world did they get up there?
Who ever heard of flying spiders? Well, says entomologist May Barenbaum, 90 years ago, people already knew there were all kinds of bugs high off the ground.
Particularly when early planes would come back with, like, aphids plastered all over them.
Aphids? You know.
Oh, yeah.
And are aphids and spiders up in the air by mistake?
Nope.
May says these animals want to be carried off, and you can see the moths and gnats and wasps deliberately launching themselves into the air, especially the turbulent level of air, just up off the ground.
They'll climb up to a high point in their own environment, even if it's just a blade of grass.
They just stand straight up on their little back legs, and just by doing that, they can get part of their body up into this layer where it's more turbulent. And then if you can get a ride on a parcel that's going up, you can get off the ground, and then if you're lucky, you can get carried aloft.
Sometimes you can see them actually leaping, but, says Matt,
the way a spider does it is it has a silken thread, which can be quite a few number of meters long.
And what the spiders who landed on Matt and his bicycle did back those many years ago is he watched them crawl to the highest point they could.
Whether it was my finger or the bell on the bicycle, stick their little butts up in the air, which is where the silk comes from, and if the silk was caught by the breeze, they'd depart again.
Insects sometimes need to leave where they are and go someplace else, either for food or sex or for a variety of reasons. Bugs and spiders disperse. And when they do,
they're kind of gambling that wherever they end up is going to be better than where they're just leaving from.
So when you go out this month and you look up at a clear blue sky and you see nothing up there but air and blue and clouds, it turns out you are standing under a vast, teeming highway of animals invisible to you, but according to bug specialists Hugh Raffles and May Barenbaum and Matt Greenstone,
there's all manner of stuff floating around up there.
They found ladybugs at 6,000 feet.
Really tiny mites, which don't even have wings.
Parasitic flies, tiny little wasps.
Cucumber beetles at 3,000 feet.
Aphids.
Lots of aphids.
Scorpion flies at 5,000 feet.
Thrips.
Micro wasps.
Little fruit flies at 3,000 feet.
And scale insects.
Yep, there's a lot of insects.
Yeah, they're all up there.
When scientists first calculated the number of bugs in the sky on a typical, summer month,
the numbers were staggering.
To count bugs, what scientists do is that they imagine, let's say, a column of air 1 mile across going way up into the sky, and then they'll measure how many insects pass through that column in a month. The most recent answer, and this was done with a radar device in Great Britain by a team headed by Jason Chapman, and we found Jason.
We estimated about 30 million large insects would pass through in a month.
Did you just say 30 million?
30 million.
And these are the large guys?
These are the large ones. Our estimate for all of the insects, including all of the aphids and the tiny creatures, was 3 billion. So that's 3,000 million.
3 billion. That's like 10 times the population of the United States going over your head.
Yeah.
That's now, enormous.
It is enormous, yes.
And the entomologists were all absolutely amazed at what they fished out of the sky.
I was surprised, no doubt about that.
Because there's so much going on right over our heads that we didn't know anything about.
It's just that we have this notion that we own the planet, and that's kind of not the case.
So. But we do have our own animation. So you can watch a spider sailing high off the earth, dangling on a teeny silk thread. You can see the all-time altitude champion, a single male termite soaring 19,000 feet up, followed by a plummet to a sea of beetles and aphids and butterflies in glorious detail at npr.org/KRULWICH. And I am Robert Krulwich at NPR News.
And that video Robert talked about at the end of his story is fantastic. And again, you can find it on the science section of our website. That's npr.org/science. And now to water. Not the waters off the Gulf Coast, but across the country in California, where scientists are studying a different kind of problem. The water in the San Francisco Bay is actually becoming clearer. And this is posing a threat to the area's fragile wetlands. Lauren Sommer has this story.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Alcatraz. Thank you very
Hundreds of tourists are pouring off the ferry on Alcatraz Island today. But two of the passengers aren't here for the historic prison. What they're looking for is underneath the dock. David Scholhammer is a hydrologist with the U.S. Geological Survey. He holds up a bottle of cloudy bay water that he just collected.
What we're measuring here is suspended sediments. You can think of it as the little microscopic rocks that are floating in the water.
To most of us, that would just be mud. But for Scholhammer, the bottle holds important clues about the bay's history. About 10 years ago, he noticed something strange in these samples. The bay's water was becoming clearer after more than a century of murkiness.
Back in the late 1800s, during the gold rush, the gold miners used essentially fire hoses and water cannons to literally wash down mountainsides to extract the gold from the sediment.
The mining sent massive pulses of earth from the Sierra foothills into the watershed.
About 250 million cubic meters of sediment deposited in the bay.
That's enough mud, rock, and sand to fill 36 million dump trucks.
It really threw everything out of whack because there was so much extra sediment.
Scholhammer says now that the extra sediment has finally worked its way out the Golden Gate, the bay's water is about 30% clearer than it was 10 years ago. That could help some fish and other species. But for the bay's shoreline, clearer doesn't always mean better.
So we're at China Camp State Park, right on the edge of San Pablo Bay, and we're on the upper part of a salt marsh.
On the water's edge in San Rafael, Professor John Calloway of the University of San Francisco and his researcher Evan Borgnes are taking a core sample of this soggy wetland by pulling up a thick aluminum tube that they've sunk into the mud.
So we just slowly push. It's stuck.
This thick mud was once sediment out in the bay. Calloway says it's key for a wetland survival. With every high tide, these marshes are built up by the sediment they trap from the water. And less sediment in the bay could spell trouble. That's because these wetlands are facing a new pressure, rising sea levels, which scientists are predicting will inundate these tidal marshes over the next century.
The big question is, how much will it go up in the future? If it goes up to 8 to 10 millimeters per year, then I think many wetlands are really unlikely to survive.
Wetlands are home to all sorts of plants and animals, from egrets to harbor seals and fish. But they also do another job, protect shoreline development from storm surges. Steve Goldbeck is with the Bay Conservation and Development Commission. He says critical infrastructure, like Oakland and San Francisco airports, are right in the path of rising waters.
What wetlands do is they can absorb those peak storm surges, those waves that are rolling in. When they hit the wetland, it knocks down the wave peaks.
With 80% of the bay's historic wetlands already destroyed, Goldbeck says restoration projects will be a vital tool to combat sea level rise. Right now, millions of cubic yards of sediment are dredged in the bay to keep shipping channels clear. Goldbeck's agency is looking at how to recycle that material now that sediment is becoming a valuable resource. For NPR News, I'm Lauren Sommer.
And to wrap it up this week, we've got two stories from the World Cup. Well, really one story, and a song. If you watched any of the games on TV this past month, you no doubt saw something different on the field. The ball used in this year's games was new, and the players say it didn't behave like a traditional soccer ball. And as Joe Palco found out, physicists say the players are right.
Before we talk about the new ball, let's talk a little about the old one. You may not realize it, but the traditional soccer ball is not really a ball at all. It's an Archimedean solid, or in this particular case,
what the mathematicians refer to as a truncated icosahedron.
That's John Eric Goff. He's a physicist at Lynchburg College and author of Gold Medal Physics. The truncated icosahedron has 32 panels in pentagonal and hexagonal shapes. But there's no law that says a soccer ball must have 32 panels. Goff says for the last World Cup, Adidas introduced a ball with 14 panels. This year's ball, called the Jabulani, has even fewer.
The Jabulani ball uses 8 thermally bonded panels.
Goff says the number of panels is important.
Balls that have rougher surfaces have different flight dynamics compared to balls with smooth surfaces.
More panels, more seams, more roughness. And oddly, that means the ball goes faster.
What happens is, as the air goes around a sphere, or a, you know, one of these sports balls, it forms a little layer near the surface of the sphere called the boundary layer.
And a rough surface means the boundary layer breaks down more rapidly when the ball flies through the air.
And what that means is the drag force on the ball, the air resistance, goes down slightly.
The Jabalani has fewer seams, but Adidas has added grooves that roughen its surface. In fact, the Jabalani has less drag, less air resistance, than a traditional ball. Goff says two Japanese scientists, Takeshi Asai and Kazuya Seo, used a wind tunnel to show that. Dutch player Giovanni van Bronckhorst learned that empirically in the semifinal match with Uruguay.
Now van Bronckhorst with pace! Oh! It is an absolute firecracker from Giovanni van Bronckhorst! 1-0 Holland!
Van Bronckhorst was about 45 yards from the goal when he struck the ball with his left foot.
It was launched at a little over 70 miles an hour coming off of his boot.
And because it was traveling so fast and the drag was less than on a traditional ball, it stayed higher in the air longer.
Now that particular kick was high up in the right corner of the goal.
Just inches out of the reach of the leaping goalkeeper. But speed isn't the only thing goalkeepers hate about the Jabalani. It knuckles funny. Okay, I'll explain. When you kick a ball, you can make it spin or not spin. If the ball doesn't spin, physicist Rabindra Mehta of NASA's Ames Research Center says it will knuckle or wobble as it flies through the air, making it hard for a goalkeeper to know where it's going.
There is an ideal speed for the maximum knuckling effect. It turns out that for a traditional ball with these 32 panels, that ideal speed was about 30 miles an hour or so.
But with the Jabalani, that ideal speed goes up to nearly 45 miles an hour, and there's still some knuckling at higher speeds, too. For goalkeepers, this is a nightmare. Marcus Hanneman was backup keeper for the U.S. team.
Well, sometimes it goes that way, sometimes it goes up, sometimes it goes down, sometimes it bends, and no one can read it.
Of course, Hanneman doesn't need to worry about that anymore. Ghana solved his problems by knocking the U.S. out of the tournament. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
If you've caught any of the World Cup, you may have heard this sound. You hear it when someone scores. You hear it when someone misses. You hear it when nothing really happens at all. This is how you hear it when I try to do it. But by now, everybody knows that the droning, blaring, endless buzzing sound that has defined the World Cup of 2010 is the previously unknown but now infamous vuvuzela, a traditional Zulu instrument that looks like a long horn with a person blowing in one end and spit flying out the other. It has been described as annoying and awful, and it plays just one note, B flat. And it turns out this note is not just special because it annoys soccer fans all over the world. It is, we think, a yet another example of what we at NPR call the B flat phenomenon.
Very clever.
Yes. Here we go.
Have you heard about B flat? A special magic frequency that is found all around in the world it abounds. There's something universal about B flat.
Start the story.
Yes, start us off, Robert.
All right, then. I read that scientists at the American Museum of Natural History once found that if you play a B flat to a male alligator...
How does one do that?
...with a tuba...
Of course a tuba.
Absolutely. So I asked a tuba player, Phil Porter, of the Cypress Lake High School Marching Band in Florida, to play a B flat to a pit of alligators. We did this for ABC Television. He did it once. Then he did it a second time. And indeed, when the alligators heard the B-flat, they began to bellow. Presumably, they mistook the B-flat for an invading alligator.
Just when they hear B-flat?
That's right, just B-flat. You play male gators a middle C, you play them a G-sharp, they just sit there. But if you are a gator, there is something about a B-flat that makes you want to bite the tuba.
All this talk of B-flat has made me want to bite a tuba.
Have you heard about B-flat? A special magic frequency that even reptiles revile and respond to with bile by croaking loudly in B-flat.
All right, Robert, what's next?
Next is the story of Glenway Fripp, a piano tuner in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. One day, Mr. Fripp was climbing some stairs. He was humming roughly in B-flat when he hit a landing, and he noticed that his hum had somehow got away from him. So he wasn't humming, but his hum was still there, bouncing off the walls without him. And Glenway thought, well, this corner seems to be shaped to hold a B-flat. And we said, could you do this again?
So we're going to walk into this corner. I'm going to be singing B-flat. And all of a sudden, my voice will disappear. And all you will hear is the resonance, because the resonance is almost equal to my voice. Okay, the note we're searching for is somewhere around this.
Okay, now we're going to put our mic into the corner. Now listen very, very closely. The corner has just grabbed hold of Mr. Glenway's tone. His B-flat has just escaped.
You can't even hear my voice, right? And that's how I discovered this. You're just talking and you... Wow, what is that weirdness jumping out at me from the... Oh.
That weirdness is a B-flat that used to belong to Mr. Fripp, but no more.
This is Glenway Fripp.
Thanks, Glenway. Anyway, speaking of resonance, did you know that I can make my digestive tract resonate in the key of B-flat?
Flat.
That sounds difficult. Did you have to practice in a... Right, this is a morning show.
Flat.
I don't see how this is universal. If it were universal, we'd be talking about the universe, but we're just talking about Earth. Robert, why don't you give us something that's not as earthly that has to do with B-flat?
Very well. Far from Earth, in 2003, astronomers found a black hole 250 million light-years away, sending waves through a cluster of gas. When they turned those waves into what for us would be a musical note, they found that black holes, in effect, hum, and this black hole was humming in...
Don't say, let me guess,
oh, yeah?
B-flat.
Exactly.
I knew it.
Yes, B-flat, 57 octaves below middle C.
Wow, that's low.
Very low, very
sort of
low.
Like this. No, but a little lower.
Lower. For whatever reason, that black hole was humming the B-flat, yes, very low, but for 2.5 billion years.
2.5 billion years. That's a long time to be humming the same thing over and over again.
Have you heard about B?
What?
That.
Oh.
A special magic frequency.
That.
Oh. Is found all around.
What's that sound? It's profound.
Oh. There's something universal about B.
B-flat. Yes.
There's something universal.
It's all
And that's it for this week's On Science podcast from NPR. For more science news, check out our website at npr.org/science. I'm Andrew Prince.